Two 10-year-old boys bonded over books on Marilyn Road in 1973, forming a friendship that would span decades and end in unthinkable tragedy. Michael Lauder and Jonathan Rosen seem destined for parallel lives of intellectual achievement, both bright Jewish kids from similar backgrounds, both headed to Yale. But Michael's house, literally propped up by thousands of books stacked like columns in the basement, foreshadowed something profound. Knowledge can be both foundation and precarious support. What neither boy could see was the genetic shadow already present in Michael's family. His grandmother Frida, whom he affectionately called crazy, actually had schizophrenia, a legacy that would eventually claim Michael himself and transform him from Yale Law School graduate to someone who would commit an act that shattered everyone who knew him. At Yale, Michael's mannered speech and confrontational style set him apart. He categorized fellow students with ethnic labels, introduced roommates as characters in a play he'd written, and clashed so intensely with one that the student fled to a psycho single. Yet Michael's brilliance was undeniable. He published letters in the New York Times challenging Harvard professors, thrived in Yale Law's gladiatorial classroom debates, and could reverse engineer readings he hadn't completed through careful listening and authoritative air. His intellectual confidence came naturally from a household where dinner was a gladiatorial debate about politics and civil liberties. What made Michael compelling was his embrace of artifice with total conviction. He never pretended to be something he wasn't. But beneath this carefully constructed persona, something was quietly shifting in his brain, preparing to fracture the brilliant mind everyone admired. One winter morning, Michael patrolled his family home with a kitchen knife, convinced his parents were Nazis. His mother locked herself in her bedroom and called police. At Columbia Presbyterian Psychiatric Ward, Michael spoke in a leaden voice about sin and repentance, revealing he'd burned his 160-page novel manuscript in the driveway as a desecration requiring atonement. When Jonathan visited, a taciturn attendant unlocked heavy doors, locking them behind. Michael sat rigidly wearing a black cloth kippah, moving with effortful stillness, like a heavy sled hauled over snow. At the barred window, he said pitiably, "Look what's become of me." This first break revealed schizophrenia's cruelest aspect. It doesn't erase the person, but traps them behind a distorting lens, leaving them partially aware of their own transformation. Michael's brilliance remained, but now it served his delusions as much as his insights. Michael's recovery meant swallowing denaturing drugs to keep delusions at bay, slowly improving while feeling worse. His reward for obedience was painful awareness of how changed he was, with growing fear he might never be himself again. He lived in Futura House, a halfway house he hated, where counselors suggested he work as a Macy's cashier, a suggestion that felt like hammerblow humiliation to someone who'd studied economics with a Nobel Prize winner. When his father, Chuck, heard this, his verdict was clear. Yale Law School would be less stressful. This decision to push Michael back toward elite achievement rather than modest stability would prove fateful. But at Yale Law, Michael found unexpected support. Dean Guido Calabresi personally carried a bed across the courtyard when Michael's dorm room had none, promising, "Steve and I will be your ramp." Professors became mentors, classmates became caretakers, and Michael carefully shared his diagnosis with a trusted circle, using humor to soften disclosure. "Worse, I'm crazy." A front-page New York Times profile titled "A Voyage to Bedlam and Partway Back" changed everything. Michael became a flaming schizophrenic activist, speaking candidly about how maintaining proper reality contact requires 70% of his mental effort. Hollywood came calling. Ron Howard offered $1.5 million for movie rights. Publishers bid $600,000 for his memoir. Michael moved to Hastings-on-Hudson with girlfriend Carrie Costello, incorporating himself as Creativity Inc. with $2.1 million in windfall earnings. But behind the success story, Carrie endured what others couldn't see. Nights when Michael wouldn't let her into their apartment because he didn't recognize her, forcing her to sleep on friends' couches. She told colleagues simply, Unfortunately, I fell in love with him lock, stock, and barrel. Once you're hooked, you're hooked. The pressure of fame, the burden of being a schizophrenia poster boy, and the expectation that his Yale credentials meant victory over illness rather than daily courage to manage an incurable condition, all of it was building toward catastrophe. On June 17, 1998, Carrie called her office reporting a personal emergency. The next day, she didn't appear for a crucial Chicago trip. Michael had stopped taking his medication and believed there were two Carries, and the one he lived with wasn't human. Despite a network of mental health professionals watching over him, they were powerless without evidence of imminent danger. Michael had managed to present himself well enough to a psychiatric mobile crisis team to avoid intervention. At 4:17 p.m. on Wednesday, his mother, Ruth, called police after Michael told her he'd killed Carrie. They found Carrie's body in the kitchen, surrounded by blood, with multiple stab wounds and her throat cut. The coroner's report revealed she had been pregnant. Forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz concluded Michael had stabbed Carrie, believing she was a non-person, a robot or doll sent to torture him. Michael Lauder's story forces us into uncomfortable territory. We celebrated him as a schizophrenia poster boy only when he wasn't noticeably schizophrenic, treating his Yale credentials as markers of victory rather than understanding the daily courage required to manage an incurable condition. His tragedy exposes how our systems, legal, medical, educational, social, fail those with severe mental illness. We have the knowledge to help, yet lack the resources and imagination to do so consistently. Behind every headline about mental illness and violence are real people caught in systems that fail them at their most vulnerable moments. Carrie Costello, brilliant and devoted, died because we as a society couldn't provide adequate care for the person she loved. Their story isn't just personal tragedy, but collective failure, a failure of resources, imagination, and ultimately, of care. If we truly want to prevent such tragedies, we must move beyond celebrating exceptional individuals who overcome mental illness and instead build systems that support everyone struggling with it every single day.